remember, relativity and quantum are those two pillars which basically change the way we think about the universe and are still tools that we use today to do research at the cutting edge. Okay, so in terms of quantum, what we're going to do is we're not going to do an historical approach, okay, with, you know, starting with Planck and all that kind of stuff, which many of you may have seen a little bit. We're just going to focus on the concepts. Okay, and the concepts are probably best illustrated, or one of the best ways to illustrate the concepts is starting with some simple experiments, single slit and double slit experiments. How many of you have talked about single and double slit experiments and seen discussion? Okay, excellent. So we'll start with the single slit and we'll move on to the double slit. Okay, so this is a single slit experiment. So what we have is a source of particles. Which I'll draw just like this sort of thing. Okay, and so what this source is doing is it's emitting particles. Okay, basically in all these different directions. So particles are coming out. Those particles are of molecular or atomic or subatomic size. Okay, so subatomic particles might include, say, for example, electrons or protons or neutrons. So let's imagine we have electrons coming out of this source. And we can generate those electrons, for example, by just taking a piece of metal, heating it up, and there's a thing called thermionic emission. The electrons fly off, and then we can accelerate those particles with an electric field. And so these particles come flying out like this. Okay, we don't really care how it works. We've got particles in motion. Okay, and these particles come off with a certain momentum, P. How many of you have encountered the concept of momentum in your study of physics? How many have not? Okay, so all of you. Okay, great. So momentum is the same thing as mass times velocity. So if these are electrons coming out, then we take the mass of the electron times the velocity of the electron. That gives the magnitude of the momentum. Okay, so we got these particles, electrons, flying out here. And I should emphasize that it doesn't matter what kind of particle we're dealing with, whether it's electrons or protons or neutrons or atoms or molecules or whatever. As long as they're small, the results of this experiment are the same. Okay? Just depends upon them being small. Okay, so these particles come flying out, and they encounter a barrier here. This is a barrier with a slit in it. Okay, so particles that are flying off in this direction, they will hit the barrier and they will bounce off like this. In fact, that'll be most of them. Okay, they're just going to hit the barrier and bounce back. But some of them will pass through this slit and go onto the other side, and they will continue flying through space, and they will hit an observing screen here. Okay, so this screen is lined with detectors of the particles that we have. We're dealing with electrons. We line this screen with electron detectors. Okay, so when the electron hits the screen at some location, a detector will click and say, oh, the electron hit over there, or oh, the electron hit over there. Okay, so this is the screen upon which we are observing the electrons as they hit that surface. Okay, so the first question I'll ask here is, given this setup, where on this screen are the electrons going to hit? If they start at this point over here and pass through this slit, where on the screen are they going to hit? Could they hit like way up here? No. Could they hit like right dead center? Okay. So they could hit dead center, and so that one could hit over here. How far can I go up here? On the same angle. Okay. So basically like this. This is sort of like the line of sight. So within this line of sight. Okay, so what we're going to see is maybe the first electron, say, hits over there, the next electron hits over there, the next electron hits over there, and so on. So they're going to hit the screen at random locations. Okay, first one, then the next, and so on. But they're only going to hit the screen within a certain range. Okay, and we'll label this the x-axis, and we'll put x equals 0 over there. So they'll range over some range, they'll hit over a certain range of the x-axis. Okay, and this region over here will be the shadow region. Okay, And so we will indicate that they hit only in this range over here and not in this range by drawing a curve like this, which is 0 here. So sort of this is the direction of number of hits is in this direction, say. The number of hits is 0 here, and then when it enters the, when it leaves the shadow region, it increases to some value, and then it decreases down to 0. So the fact that it's even here means that it's equally likely that any given electron will maybe hit there or there or there with equal probability. And so the electrons will basically fill up this part of the screen, and none of them will go over there. Yeah?
How long?
Well, it depends on the kind of particles you're dealing with, and it's small. Like we're dealing with electrons. This is of atomic dimensions. And we'll talk about a particular experiment. I'll show you the results of a particular
experiment.
Wouldn't
that mean that the uncertainty principle will rule and it really would go flying around?
That's right. So we're going to get to that. Okay. So right now what we're saying is it's certainly true that if the momentum of these particles is large, if these electrons are moving very fast, this is the pattern that we will see, and this is the pattern we expect to see. Okay, so this is for large momentum. Okay, but now something very curious happens. If we start cranking down the momentum, if we turn down the momentum of these particles, they come flying out slower and slower and slower. What we find is something very odd. We find that particles are no longer confined to this region. We can have particles hitting out here. Okay, and maybe a particle hits over here. So the situation kind of looks like this. Maybe the first particle hits, if we've turned down the momentum, the first particle might, say, hit over there, because that's expected. Second particle might hit over there, that's expected. But then every once in a while we'll have a particle hitting out there in the shadow region. Okay, another particle hitting over there, then the third particle over there, fourth particle over there. So you'll get particles hitting also in the shadow region. Okay, and so our curve for the sort of the pattern of hits here will look something like this. It'll be spread out. It'll look something like that. Okay, and so this by this curve I mean there's a high probability it'll hit in this region over here where the curve has a high value. But there's a low value, and in decreasing probability it will hit the screen up here. But still some non-zero probability. Okay, and if we keep on increasing the momentum even more, decreasing momentum even more, so this is smaller. If we decrease the momentum even more, what we find is that these electrons can hit even further away from this normal region here. They can penetrate further into the shadow region. Maybe some of them now hit way up there or way down there. Okay, so this pattern of hits spreads out even more. Okay, and so it might look something like that. It's even broader like that. Okay, so this is very small. Okay. So those are, you can do this experiment, and these are the results. So let me just sort of summarize the important points about this experiment. There are two important points. The first is the concept of randomness has entered here. Okay? So it turns out that the electrons which are emitted here, even though we try to emit this, the electrons in the same sort of state all the time, it turns out that that we can't actually predict in advance where any given electron will hit the screen. Okay, so suppose the momentum of the electrons is such that we are dealing with this pattern of hits over here. Okay, then we can't tell in advance where any given electron will hit. All we can tell is it's more likely, it's more probable they'll hit in this region and less probable in this region. And so this curve here, this pattern of hits, is like a probability curve. Okay, and so that's in fact what we'll call it. So we'll call these types of curves P of X, a probability curve. Okay, so P of X is related to the probability that a given electron, that's a symbol for an electron, will hit at the position x on the screen. So we can't predict in advance exactly where it will hit. There's true randomness in the universe, a kind of randomness that is more fundamental than the randomness in rolling a die. Okay, and we'll talk a lot about that as we go along. But anyways, just at the outset here, this pattern of hits is a probability curve. It's a probability pattern associated with the randomness. Okay, the second main thing that we notice about these experimental results is that this pattern of hits, or this probability curve, this function of x, spreads out as we reduce the momentum. Okay, when the momentum is large, very fast-moving electrons, the probability curve looks like that. As we turn the momentum down, the probability curve spreads out more and more and more. Okay, so that's the second thing, is this spreading. Okay, so spreading as the momentum of the particles, electrons in our case, is reduced. Okay, so why? Why is that happening? How is it possible for an electron, which is a particle, to somehow hit the screen over there? I mean, how is it? I mean, it's floating through space like this, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, and you would expect it to just hit somewhere in this range here. How does it somehow bend its path and go up to there? Okay, so we're jumping ahead. So it has something to do with waves, yeah. So we can describe, it turns out that we will be able to describe this probability pattern by thinking about not particles going through, but waves going through. And we will get to that. Okay, so but the first thing we notice here is that something certainly odd is going on. Okay, and we might need to think a little bit differently about how to describe how small particles like electrons behave. Okay, so those are the two main points. So for the single slit experiment, let's now talk about the double slit experiment. Okay, so so it's a similar situation here. What we have is a source of particles, say electrons. These electrons are coming out with a momentum p, mass times velocity. Okay, and there's a barrier here. But instead of having just one slit, we're going to have two slits in this barrier. Okay, so it'll look like this. And then we have an observing screen over here. Now, let's suppose that temporarily, let's call these two slits number one and number two. Let's suppose that we temporarily close slit number two. Okay, so we block it off like that. What pattern of hits am I going to see on this screen here? Where is it going to be maximum? Where's the most likely point it's going that electrons are going to hit this this screen? From the line of sight. Okay, so basically, from the line of sight, we're going to have a probability pattern which is maximum here, most likely to hit around here. But we're going to imagine that the momentum is low enough so that there's a very broad spread in that pattern. Okay, so like a single slit over here, what we've done is when we crank the momentum very low, we get a very broad pattern of hits. So we're going to imagine that our momentum here is low enough so that we have a very broad pattern of hits. So here I have only one colored chalk. Okay, so the pattern might look something like this. So it's very broad like this. Very spread out. Okay? So that's with slit number two closed. And let's pick a certain point on the screen here. Let's make this a little bit more concrete. Okay, so this is x equals 0 over here. And we see that the maximum occurs at some positive value of x here. And let's just pick some point here, say this point over here. Say it's some distance d away from the center. And suppose that we fire, like, I don't know, 1,000 electrons, one at a time, one, then the next, and the next. One electron hits here, then here, and so on and so forth. And suppose that in a small region around D here, we have a certain number of electrons hit. So suppose that this corresponds to, I don't know, let's say 7 hits. Okay, so that means that when we send 1,000 electrons through here, 7 of them hit in this little region over here, located at D, centered on D. Okay. Now let's suppose now that instead of closing slit number 2, we close instead slit number 1. So it's a single slit experiment again. So the result is that electrons are most likely to hit the screen along the line of sight here. So our probability pattern is going to be peaked here. But we'll assume that the momentum is large enough, or sorry, small enough, so that we have a large spread. Okay, so this guy goes like this. So it's symmetrical. This guy is the same as this guy, but just shifted over. Okay. All right. So now let's suppose then that with this only this second slit open, suppose that when we fire, say, 1,000 electrons through here, we find that maybe, say, 3 of them end up in this region over here, at the screen there. Okay. Okay. So that's that. Now, what happens if we were to open both slits? How many electrons, when we fire 1,000, how many electrons are going to hit in this region here? 10, right. So we'd expect, you know, 7 plus 3 is 10. Okay. And so what we're saying here is that when we open both slits, the pattern of hits that we expect to see is just this pattern. This is, let's call this pattern here P1, P1 of x. So that's the pattern of hits when just slit 1 is open. And let's call this guy here P2. So that's the pattern of hits when just slit 2 is open. Okay, so it's peaked around here and then drops off to either side. So what we're saying is that when we have both slits open, what we expect is that the pattern for both slits open should just be the sum. Okay, so what is that? So let's add this to this, so that looks like that. And then add this to this, that looks like that. So it looks something like this. So what we would expect with both slits open is that the pattern is sort of peaked around here, say, and then drops off to either side. It's the sum of those two. So are we happy with that? That's a reasonable expectation, right? Okay. So what we actually see is this, and I'll just sort of draw it to the side over here. I'll draw a new x-axis here, a new screen over here. And I'll show you what we actually see. So there's 0, and say there's that point D. What we see, what we expect to see is this guy over here. Okay, what we actually see is something completely different. Okay, it's not just a little bit, it's totally different. It looks like this. Okay, it looks like that. Okay, so it's totally different. And moreover, if we look at this point on the screen, the fact that this pattern of hits goes to 0 here, what that means is there's 0 probability that electrons will hit over here, and 0 probability they'll hit over here. In other words, when we're firing electrons toward this barrier with two slits open like this, what we find is electrons, the first electron might hit over there, the second electron might hit over there. It's totally random where they hit. The third one over there, the fourth one over there, fifth one over there, and so on. Okay, so they're going to be popping, they're going to be hitting the screen at these different locations randomly. And if we fire a whole bunch of electrons, a pattern starts to emerge. And the pattern looks like this, saying that lots of electrons will hit around here, or around here, or around here, or around here, wherever this curve is high. But very few electrons will hit around here, and 0 will hit there. Okay? This is completely bizarre, because if I have just, say, slit number one open, it's certainly possible for electrons to get from there through that slit to that point on the screen. Okay. If I have just slit number two open, it's certainly possible for electrons to get from the source to that point on the screen. But now, the experimental results tell me that if I open both slits, suddenly it's impossible for electrons to get to that point on the screen. Even if the electrons are being sent one at a time, we send one electron, click, okay, it passes through this apparatus, hits the screen somewhere. We wait 5 seconds, we send another electron, boom, send it through the apparatus, it hits the screen over there, and so on. And very slowly, over, say, an hour, a pattern builds up. But at any given time, there's only ever one electron in this apparatus. And somehow, with both slits open, the electrons somehow know to avoid these points. Isn't that odd? That is profoundly odd. Okay? So we're going to try to make sense of this. Okay, so but first I want to show you an actual experiment. So Sean, who is our AV guy, Sean, can we like lower the screen? Excellent. Thank you, Sean. Okay. So I want to show you this is an actual experiment done. This is actually a hard experiment to do with electrons. It seems like a simple experiment,
right? Now
we are
looking at the detector plane on the monitor.
Wait.
Bright spots appear here and there.
Stop.
These spots indicate individual electrons. Electrons are sent out only occasionally.
Okay. Here we go. Now let me just have to do this function F4 thing. Make sure this comes up. Okay. So it'll take a second. It's a little bit slow. So this is an actual experiment of this double slit type. And the technology involved here is quite tricky, because for electrons, it turns out that the distance between these slits needs to be of the order of just several atoms. So we had to, human beings had to evolve to the point where they could manipulate things at the level of atoms to be able to do this experiment. So this was done actually, I'm not sure when, but in the last like 10 or 15 years or something by the Hitachi Corporation. And why is it not coming up? Yeah, but it should. Okay, that looks worse. Okay, I'm just going to push play.
Okay. Now we are looking at the detector plane on the monitor. Bright spots appear here and there. These spots indicate individual electrons. Electrons are sent out only occasionally. Therefore, the chance of finding one electron in the microscope is very small, not to mention the chance of finding two.
Okay, so this screen over here, this is looking at this screen here, sort of face on. Okay, and so there are two slits that are vertical like this that the electrons can pass through, and the screen is over here. And we're seeing electrons hitting the screen at random locations. So you can see the randomness. The one is there, one is there, one is there. And you will see over time a pattern build up. Notice that there's only one electron in the apparatus at any given time. The electrons are not somehow, you know, interacting with each other or something. It's just each a single electron.
Since electrons are detected one by one as particles, we have to conclude that each electron must have passed through at random on either side of the biprism, thus creating a uniform distribution without any interference when accumulated.
Okay, so the word biprism here, bi means two, and biprism is the technical term for that double slit there.
Under such condition, do electrons form a uniform distribution? But look, we begin to see some fringes in the perpendicular direction that looks like interference fringes. Since this experiment lasted for more than 30 minutes, I have sped the movie up. interference fringes are now clearly visible.
Okay, so where it's bright there, that indicates a high point here, and where it's dark, that indicates a low point here. So you see this pattern emerging, pattern of hits or probability pattern. Okay, so that's really freaky. How are we going to make sense of this? Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
That means that that always some points where many atoms hit, they are not all equal. I mean, the ones in the middle get more atoms than one in size.
Oh, so you're saying that here these are actually brighter than here. Oh yeah. So this pattern, I've not drawn it super carefully. Take this pattern and maybe, yeah, it does get a little bit lower.
And they also get wider too.
Lower. So I haven't drawn it super accurately. So the central one is biggest, and then as you move to the sides, as you move away from the center, the probability pattern is a little bit lower. And the spacing here might not be totally uniform. Okay, so I'm just trying to show you this representative. But the main point is there are points on the screen where the electrons don't hit. Okay, and that's what we need to try to make sense of. All right. So hello. Okay. Okay, so it turns out that a way to try to make sense headway with what's going on here is to compare these experiments that we do with particles with similar experiments except done with waves. So this is not a source of particles, we replace it with a source of waves. Okay, so let's have a look at that. All right, so let's look at the single slit experiment again. And an experiment done with waves, which exhibits a property of waves called diffraction. How many of you have studied diffraction in your physics studies so far? How many have not? Never seen diffraction? Okay, a couple. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about diffraction. And those of you who have said you've studied it, I'm going to ask you to explain it. Okay, So instead of having a source of particles, we have a source of waves. Okay, and these waves are emitted. Say, they come out like this. Okay, I could draw the whole spherical wavefront, but whatever. I'm just drawing a part of the sphere, spherical wavefront that moves outwards like this. And these spherical waves, they encounter a single slit like this, and they pass. And most of those waves, they're just going to hit the barrier and they're going to bounce off. These waves over here, this part of the wavefront is going to hit the barrier over here and bounce off like that in that direction. Okay? But some of the wave will pass through this barrier. Okay? And we have an observing screen over here. So we're sitting at this screen and we will see waves coming at us. And what we're going to be measuring is the intensity of the waves. How big is the fluctuation? Maybe they're water waves, maybe they're sound waves. If they're sound waves, we'll measure how loud they are, okay, at different points along this screen. So again, we'll label this with x, and the central point is x equals 0. And now, let me ask you, what do I expect to see here, first of all? Suppose that the wavelength is very small. This is the wavelength, by the way. So each one of these lines denotes a wave crest, and these wave crests are expanding outwards like this as they move. And they move at some speed, speed of sound or speed of water or whatever. Speed of waves, I'm always just indicating with the letter C. Okay? And this is the wavelength. This is the distance between two neighboring wave crests. And as these wave crests move out, that distance remains the same. So they just go like that. Okay, so what sort of a thing am I going to see here? Suppose that the wavelength is very, very small. So we're dealing with, say, very, very small compared to the size of the slit. Okay? A good example is sunlight coming in through a window. Okay, so sunlight, the wavelength for light is what? How big is it? Very small. Okay, so it's the distance between my tightly pressed together fingers. Okay, so very, very small. And compared to the size of the window. So if that's the case, then my waves look like this. They're extremely closely centered like this. And these waves are passing through this window here. And what do I see here? Where does the sunlight hit? Right, so right where you'd expect it, okay? So following lines of sight between the two edges from the source past the edge here. Okay, what you would expect, and so this is the shadow region, and this is shadow again. Okay, and so what you would expect is an intensity of waves that looks something like this. Okay, it's basically broad, so it's basically sunlight hitting this entire range over here. I shouldn't have drawn that there. So we have sunlight hitting here, but no sunlight hitting here. Okay, so we see a pattern which looks like this. And what I'm drawing here is actually the square of the amplitude of the waves. So the amplitude of the wave squared. Okay, so waves, you know, of course, are plus and minus. Okay, and so when I square a wave, then a plus becomes a plus, but a minus becomes a plus. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm just squaring the amplitude of the waves, and that's called the intensity. So just the intensity of the sunlight is large here, and then just drops to zero in the shadow region. So now what happens if I were to increase the wavelength? So instead of using light, I use a lower frequency of electromagnetic radiation. So I use, say, infrared or go down to radio waves, that sort of thing. What's going to happen to those waves as they pass through this slit? Can someone describe what's going to happen? Yeah. Right. So instead of so in the case of the sunlight, we had just this. Okay, but if we increase the wavelength, then we find that those wave crests here actually extend into the shadow region. Okay, and so it's said that the wave diffracts. Okay, it spreads out. Such that the intensity of the wave on the screen here spreads out. Okay, so now some light can hit here, or now some sound can hit here, depending on the kind of wave we're dealing with. Okay, so it looks something like that. Okay, so for example, if you're standing in the bistro and I'm yakking away here, yak yak yak, you can hear me, even though you're not in the line of sight. Okay, so here's me yak yak yak. That's the door to the room over here, and here you are in the bistro over here. So you're not in the line of sight, and yet you can still hear me because sound waves diffract through an aperture, diffract through a slit like this. Okay, and so sound waves can bend around corners. Light waves can bend around corners. Any kind of wave can bend around corners. Can anyone explain why that happens, how that happens?
Yeah. Well, in this example, or in the door example, like your slit acts as like a new like wave propagation point. So then like at every corner, if you want to call it that, like a new wave will begin, and then it'll just propagate from there.
Yeah, so that's called Huygens principle. So a guy called Huygens figured that out way back when. And what happened to the eraser? Oh, there. Okay, so you might want to Google this, get some more information on this. But basically, the picture is something like this. Here is our single slit here, and here is a wave crests passing through this slit. So when the wave crest is in the slit over here, what it does is it acts like at every point on the wave crest acts like a new source of waves, okay, a spherical source of waves. And these guys go like this, and so on. And when you add up all those wave crests, you get this wave. And then on this wave crest, each of the points on those wave crests acts like a new point source, and you have little waves coming out. So they all add up. And so what you get is this. You get a diffraction. Instead of just being like that, it bends wider. It spreads out. Okay? So I'll let you look that up on Google or whatever. Okay, so that's what happens here. Now let me just indicate some conditions here. So when the wavelength is small, we see an intensity pattern which looks like this. So this is for small wavelength. Okay, so like light going through a window. But for a wavelength that is long or large or comparable to the size of the slit, then we see this spreading out. So this is for large. For example, sound through the door and all that kind of stuff. Okay? Right. Okay, so let's compare these two pictures here. We're comparing that picture with that picture there. And we find that there appears to be sort of at least loosely a relationship between the probability pattern of hits for an electron and the intensity pattern of waves. Okay? And in fact, this the pattern there is identical to the pattern. The patterns you get there are identical to the patterns you get here. Okay? And so the first thing it suggests is that we identify wave intensity with particle probability. Okay, so it's very important to notice this here is a wave concept, wave intensity. And we are identifying that with a particle idea. Okay. So somehow we are, at the end of the day, what we are going to do is we are going to use wave ideas to describe the probabilistic behavior of electrons. The second thing that we notice is that in this experiment, when the wavelength is small, okay, when the wavelength is small, we notice that there is no waves go into the shadow region. Okay, what condition is analogous in the particle case? Large p. Okay, so small lambda, we get this square sort of pattern here, nothing in the shadow region. That's the same as for large p. We get nothing in the shadow region. So small wavelength seems to correspond, if we were to try to make a correspondence between those two pictures, small lambda corresponds to large momentum. And vice versa. Large momentum, in the wave picture, we see a lot of spreading. Under what conditions do we see a lot of spreading in the particle picture? Small momentum. Okay, so when lambda is large, p is small. When lambda is small, p is large. That suggests that there may be some relationship between the lambda in this picture and the p in this picture. What kind of a relationship? Inverse. Okay, so it suggests, or we guess, something of this form, that lambda, that the lambda in the wave picture might be related to the inverse, 1 over the momentum. And this is a proportional. So lambda is proportional to 1 over p, some proportionality constant. Okay? I'm saying guess here because that's what you do in physics. Nature is deeply mysterious. We just don't know how it works. And everyone, and most of the time, you know, we come across as day-to-day situations, but then we do an experiment like this double slit experiment. We see something totally bizarre like this, and we try to make sense of it. Okay, or this single slit, this spreading and so on. And so we're just sort of guessing that there's some relationship like this. And then at the end of the day, we verify that guess by doing experiments. And that gives us more confidence that, yes, maybe something like this is true as we do more and more experiments. Okay, so that's how physics works, and we're in the process of doing physics. Okay, let's now look at the double slit experiment, but instead of having particles passing through the double slit, we're going to have waves. Okay, and this brings up a phenomenon characteristic of waves called interference. Okay, so the setup is then this. Instead of particles coming out of our source, we have waves. So here they are, successive wave fronts coming out and moving to the right. Okay, and then they encounter a barrier with two slits. And they hit our screen. And here is x equals 0. Okay? So now what we're going to imagine is that we have turned the wavelength up. Okay? So we've cranked the wavelength. We've made a long wavelength waves passing through our slits so that there is a great deal of diffraction. There's a great deal of spreading through each of the individual slits. Okay, so as these wave fronts, most of these wave fronts, you know, most parts of the wave fronts will just bounce off. But the part of the wave front that passes through this slit, instead of just going like line of sight like that, it's going to there's going to be significant diffraction. And so it looks something like that. So it has spread quite a bit. And similarly, the part of the wave front that passes through the lower slit there, what we called slit number 2, is also going to experience serious amounts of diffraction. It's going to spread a lot. Okay, so what we have, so both of them spread such that there's a significant overlap between this set of waves and that set of waves. And where those waves overlap, we have a phenomenon occurs called interference. Okay, so when one, say a crest here meets a crest here, like at that point, we have a double crest. Okay, when a trough is, so here is just terminology here. This is a crest, this is a trough down here. Okay, negative. So a trough, if this is a crest and that's a crest, then halfway in between is a trough. So when a trough from this set of waves meets a trough from this set of waves, say at this location, we have a double trough. Okay, and so double crest, double trough means the intensity is large. Okay? Whereas if we have a point where a crest from one, say here, meets a trough from the other, there's going to be cancellation. Okay? And at this point over here, at that instant of time, there will be no wave. It'll just be zero intensity. Okay, so what we find is there are certain places where there's cancellation and so on, and the intensity pattern for the waves that we observe at the screen looks like this. In fact, it looks exactly like that. Okay, so so one thing I just want to point out. Okay, let's put this up here. Oh, yeah.
And then more interference near the zero, because there's everywhere interference, and the intensity is everywhere the same, isn't it?
Okay, so there's more interference, positive constructive interference over here.
Yeah,
because,
why?
Sorry?
Why?
Because if you look at, say, a wave and getting from here to here, okay, part of the wave crest here, so a wave crest gets emitted. Part of that wave crest goes through the upper slit, and then is diffracted and ends up over here. So part of the wave crest goes along this path, and part of the wave crest, this part down here, goes along this path, and then gets diffracted through here and ends up going over here. Okay? So for waves, waves can get to this point by either going through that path, through the upper slit, or through the lower slit. Okay? And if you look at just by the symmetry of this picture, you can see that the path length from there to there is the same if you go via the upper slit or if you go via the lower slit. They travel the same distance. Okay, so that little bit of wave crest and that little bit of wave crest emitted at the same time here, which are traveling at the speed of sound or water or whatever, will travel the same distance, and so they will arrive at the same time. So you will have wave crests from here arriving at the same time as wave crests from here, and you will get double crests, and you will get lots of amplitude here. Whereas if you look at a point like this,
Now the diagram is going to get a bit messy. For waves to get to this point, they need to take one possible path is this path. Another possible path is through the lower slip, like that. Now, if you compare the difference between the path difference, okay, the length of this path from here through the upper slip to there, to the length of this path from here through the lower slip to there, you'll see that it's a difference in length.
They're different in length, right? So when two wave crests here, two bits of wave crest start at the same time and move along here like this, okay, the time that's going to take for them to get there is different. This is a longer path. By the time this wave crest reaches that point, this wave crest, because it has traveled a greater distance, will be behind. It'll be only over there. Okay, and so what might be hitting it is actually a trough. So you have a crest and a trough adding up to get zero there. I'm not answering the question.
Oh, just because as you go over here, the total distance gets longer, and waves as they spread out, they decrease in amplitude. The waves are everywhere, but if I have a wave, if I have a say a point source of waves like this in a pond, okay, and I'm dipping my finger in and out of a pond, then I have big waves near the point at which I'm creating the waves. But as those waves spread out, get larger, you know, further and further and further, the amplitude of the waves gets less and less and less. Right? I mean, you don't see a mile away from your dipping in the pond, you don't see big waves like this anymore. Right? You see these little things. So the amplitude decreases the further the distance is. And so that's why this just these peaks get slightly lower as you go further away from the central mass. In fact, you asked this question about this thing, and so the same thing is happening there. Okay. All right. So so let's look at this in a little bit more detail. There's a very important point here. So far we have guessed that there's a relationship possibly between wavelength and momentum, an inverse relationship. And that maybe lambda is somehow proportional to 1 over momentum. Turns out that we can actually determine that proportionality constant very accurately in an experiment, in a double slit experiment of this type. Okay, so the way we do that is this. Suppose that the wavelength that I'm using here is very small. Okay, so the waves are like this, very, very close together. Okay, what do you expect this pattern to look like?
Close together.
Close together. Okay, so we see the whole thing scrunched up. So when we go from light to dark or light to dark, it'll happen more rapidly. Okay, so what we expect for small lambda is a pattern like this, very tight like this. So this is for small. Okay. If we make the wavelength large, what happens to this pattern? It stretches out like that. Okay, so we're going to see. So here's the central mass. Now it's still the same, but now it spreads out like that. Okay, and what we're trying to do is, so this is for large one. So what we can do is we can conduct this experiment and vary the wavelength here, and so vary the tightness of this pattern until that pattern exactly matches this pattern. So suppose we've done an experiment with a given momentum, and we get some pattern of probability of hits that looks exactly like that, where the first minimum occurs at some distance d away from the central maximum. Okay, so we want to get exactly this pattern. So what we do is we just vary the wavelength from small to large until we get exactly the right pattern, which matches the probability pattern for the particle case. Let's just say like that, where the distance from the central maximum to the first minimum is exactly d. So this is wavelength just right. Okay, so the point is, for any given momentum, we get a certain pattern.
Then we conduct a similar experiment using the same apparatus here, but use waves. Play with the wavelength until the pattern we get exactly matches the pattern we got for particles. Okay? And that will give us a particular wavelength associated with a particular momentum. And that allows us to determine the proportionality constant. So we adjust the wavelength such that the intensity, the amplitude squared, exactly matches the probability pattern. Okay? And when that happens, there's a definite, for a definite p, there's a definite lambda. And so we can determine the relationship between lambda and p. Okay? And so there's a proportionality constant here, which we're calling h. And we can then determine that proportionality constant. Okay? And if you do it numerically, and if you do this, you get experiments give you h is 6.626 times 10 to the minus 34, and the units are joule seconds. Okay? So the conversion factor to go from momentum here to a wavelength is a joule second. Okay? And the numerical value is this 6 times 10 to the minus 34. What is this constant called? Okay, so this is Planck's constant. What is this relationship called? The Broglie wavelength. So this is okay, so people say that that's pronounced de Broglie. Okay, I don't get it, but so we'll go with de Broglie. Okay, so are we all okay here? All is clear? All right, so because this is important. So we've come up with a relationship between a wavelength and a momentum. Okay, so we've looked at the results of these crazy experiments. And we said that, okay, what's happening with the electron, what's happening with the particle, is just totally bizarre. Okay, when I have this double slit situation like this, with just one slit open, electrons for sure should hit there, or do hit there. With just the other slit open, electrons also hit there. But with both slits open, suddenly they no longer hit at that point. Okay, and so you get some weird pattern like this. Okay? And then we used our familiarity with waves to say, hey, I recognize that pattern. That's just the double slit interference pattern with waves. Okay? And then we establish a correspondence between the momentum of the particles and the corresponding wavelength of the waves. So what's happening here is something like this. We're saying, I don't know what the electron is doing. Okay? In getting from here to here, this very fact that with both slits open, it no longer hits there, that very fact just totally baffles me. I have no idea what an electron is anymore. Okay? I mean, I know it's a particle here and it's a particle there, but I have no idea what it's doing in getting from here to here. It makes no more sense to me. Okay? And I also realize that I can't actually predict in advance where a given electron is going to hit the screen. So I'm dealing just with a probability pattern, P of x. And what we're saying is that you can actually calculate this P of x. Okay? By doing a similar experiment with waves. Okay, so I have particles with some momentum p, and I want to predict what's the probability pattern. Well, the way that I do that is I just take my momentum p, plug it into here, h divided by that p gives me a number, lambda. And it says that if I do an experiment with waves instead of particles with that wavelength lambda, I will get a wave intensity pattern which exactly matches my probability particle. My particle probability pattern. Okay? So what we're doing is we're saying, I don't really know what the electron is doing. All I can talk about is probabilities. And I'm using wave concepts to describe or to calculate those probabilities. Okay, so what we have here is sort of like the analog, the quantum analog of F equals MA. Okay, so F equals MA applies to things like baseballs and cars and things like that, right? If I throw a baseball here, it starts with some initial position and some initial velocity. And I say, oh, well, gravity is acting. And so I know what its acceleration will be and so on. So I use F equals MA, and I can predict the trajectory of that baseball. That's how physics works, right? We have some law of motion, F equals MA, which allows us to predict the behavior of objects, in this case, a baseball or a car or something. Okay, but we notice that that kind of thing doesn't seem to be happening here. Something really weird is going on here. Okay, and so what we end up with is not F equals ma. What we end up with is something is this thing, this de Broglie relation, some wave relationship between lambda and p. So what we're going to try to do, this is really interesting, what we're going to try to do is use this newfound relationship, try to use it like we would use F equals ma, to learn something about the behavior of electrons in various situations. Okay, so we scrap this, we try to use that to understand how electrons behave. And the simplest example of this, and the most interesting, simplest example that leads to really interesting results is called the particle in the box. So we're going to take a particle, be that an electron or a neutron or a proton, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what it is. As long as it's small, you know, atomic or subatomic, we are going to be able to use that lambda equals h over p to learn something about its behavior. Okay, so when I say particle in a box, you probably have in mind a box like this, and the particle is doing something inside that box. So what I'm going to do is, first of all, reduce the number of dimensions down to one. Okay, so we're going to imagine that it's really like this. We have like a wire here, and we have a bead. There's a bead on the wire. Okay, and in the non-quantum world, what you can do is give that bead a kick, and it will bounce back and forth. And it's frictionless and all that stuff. Okay, so we're just imagining a particle in a one-dimensional box. So it's confined to the x-axis between two limits. So by particle in a box, I mean the particle is confined between x equals 0 and x equals L. There's a barrier here that it reflects off of. And we'll assume that the particle here has some mass m. Okay, what it's doing classically, when I say classical, I mean non-quantum. I mean just ordinary kind of physics, Newtonian physics. What it's doing classically, if I kick it like this, it just bounces back and forth. Quantum mechanically, what it's doing is something rather bizarre. Okay, and so I don't even know how to indicate that. So it's whatever. It's something. It's doing something. Okay, now the only thing, and we're going to try to figure out what that is. Now the only thing we're going to say about this is that we suppose that it has a definite amount of energy. Okay, so suppose energy, it has an energy E. Okay, so many joules of energy. So somehow we've given that particle some energy. Maybe we've flicked it with our finger like this. We've given it a certain amount of energy. And what we're going to try to do is use this de Broglie relationship to learn about what it's doing. Okay, so first of all, what kind of energy does it have? Just classically. Kinetic. It's just kinetic, right? So it's just bouncing back and forth, just kinetic. So I can say E is 1/2 mv squared. What is that in terms of momentum? Right. So that's the same thing as p squared divided by 2m. If I replace v with v with p over m, I get this. And this is actually the, it turns out that in quantum mechanics, momentum is much more important than velocity. Nature doesn't care about velocity. Nature only seems to care about momentum. Okay, so let's see. So what does that tell us? If I solve for p, I have this relation of E is equal to p squared over 2m. I'm saying we have a definite energy, say 5 joules or something. How do I solve for p? What's p? Is everyone happy with that? Really? You guys are happy with that?
Yeah, well,
plus or minus.
Uh-huh. Well, is momentum is pronounced vectorially or?
Yeah, so we're thinking of this as px. Actually, in an abusive notation, I will be thinking of either the magnitude of p or px, depending upon the context, I will be using the symbol p for. Okay, and you'll just see from the context.
what I mean here. So by p here, I mean really px, momentum in the x direction, can be plus this number or minus that number. Okay. So, and that's very important. This is a very important lesson. It turns out that in physics, like what do you do in physics? Basically, you look at the world, you try to make some sense of it, and then you convert your sense of that into mathematical language. And then you play with the math, and you find solutions. You basically try all of the, like in this case, there are two solutions. And both of those solutions are very, very important. The point is that whenever you've got some mathematical expression, or you're trying to solve some equation or something, always look at the most general solution. A good example of that is Dirac, when he was when he combined the ideas of special relativity with quantum. There was a similar sort of a plus-minus sign, okay, and that was closely related to the idea of antimatter. Okay, so if he had just ignored the minus sign, then it would just be sort of matter, but adding that minus sign is related to antimatter. Okay, or the fact there's two signs is related to antimatter. Okay, so let's see. So here we have a particle. Its momentum is either plus this or minus this. When it's plus, it means that it's moving to the right. When it's minus, it's moving to the left. Okay, so right, left. All right. So what is the wavelength, corresponding wavelength? So now we're saying, okay, I know what p is. In this relationship, p means the magnitude of the momentum. Okay, so because lambda wavelength is always positive. So I'm trying to use this relationship to learn something about these particles, particle behavior. So what is the corresponding wavelength? It's h divided by the magnitude of the momentum, which is just h over root 2 me. It's a positive number. Okay, so what we've done is we've started by saying the only thing I'm going to assume is that the particle has some mass m and that it has some energy e. And then by applying and doing whatever some reasoning over here, we've ended up with the statement that associated with that particle whose energy is e, there is some kind of a wave whose wavelength is h divided by the square root of 2 me. If I give you e, you know what the momentum is. Okay, so that's the first thing. So now let's look at those waves. Let's try to imagine the presence of waves in that box, because somehow that de Broglie relationship is suggesting associated with that particle is some kind of wave. If we put a wave in a box, some interesting things happen. Okay, so let's look at these. First of all, suppose that the momentum is plus square root of 2 me. That means that the particle is moving to the right. And so we would also expect that whatever wave is associated with that wavelength, lambda, is also moving to the right. That would be a reasonable thing to imagine. Okay, so we've got a wave that's moving to the right, like this. But this particle is bound to the box. Okay, when the particle hits x equals l, there it bounces off. What happens when a wave hits a boundary like that? It reverses and it reflects. It reflects back like this. We have this reflected wave coming back. And when we add up those two waves, what do we get? We get interference, yeah. Standing waves, yeah, all that stuff, constructive, destructive interference, and so on. Yes. So the point is, if we have a particle moving to the right, then that somehow corresponds to a wave moving to the right. If we have a wave moving to the right, we necessarily have a wave moving to the left, like this. And there's going to be some interference between those two waves. Okay, so there's necessarily a reflected wave. Okay, now I want you to notice that if you've got a particle, the reflection of the particle is no problem, right? So here the particle is localized, right? It just buzzes along like this, and then dunk, it bounces off, right? Whereas the wave, all we're told is that we have a wave of wavelength lambda. We're not told how long the wave is. Like, it's a wave train. We're not told how long it is. Okay.
So it's not like it's just a tiny bit of a wave like that. Okay, all we're told is has a wavelength lambda. One wavelength lambda. And so it's a continuous, actually a continuous wave train like this associated with that particle. Okay, and so when it bounces off, we get another continuous wave train like that. And so this interference pattern is over a distributed size here. Okay, it's not just at the particle. Okay. This is the side point here. Okay, what if P is minus root 2 ME? Classically, or non-quantum mechanically, that corresponds to a particle moving to the left. And so somehow there's the suggestion that we have a wave moving to the left. When it reflects off of this barrier, we're going to get a wave moving to the right, and we're going to get some kind of interference pattern. So basically, we are forced into a superposition of waves. So because we've got a barrier here, if we've got a right-moving wave, we necessarily have a left-moving one. If we have a barrier here, if we have a left-moving one, we necessarily have a right-moving one. Okay, so we're forced to have two waves that are present simultaneously, a superposition of right and left. Okay, so that's really important. Now let's actually look at an applet here. So Sean, I wonder if you could turn on the projector again, bring down the screen. Thank you. Okay. So this is a really cool applet. Let's have a look at it. Okay. So this is an applet which shows the reflection of a wave. Oops. All right, so it should come on. No, it's not on. Let's try that. Okay, well, there's something. But then that disappeared. Okay. Okay. All right, so here we see a wave, which is, there's our little pointer here. So here we see a wave which is traveling to the right. Okay, so, and it's going to encounter a barrier here, and it's going to reflect from that barrier. Okay, so this wave is a continuous wave train with a certain wavelength. The wavelength is the distance from between these two troughs here, or between those two crests. Okay, and when it encounters the barrier, there's a reflection. Okay, so this is the reflected wave in blue, which is coming back. Okay, so we have the red wave is moving to the right, the blue wave is the reflected wave moving to the left, and then there's a black wave here, which shows the sum of the two. Okay, they interfere with each other, and crests add to crests, and troughs add to troughs, crests and troughs cancel each other out, and so on and so forth. Okay, and so the black indicates the shows the superposition or the combination of the left and the right moving wave. Okay, so what you'll notice is what we end up with is an interesting pattern of waves. So we still got the right moving and the left moving, but their sum is something which is not moving at all. It's neither moving to the right nor the left. Like, look at this peak here. It just the peak goes up and down, okay, but the location of the peak never changes. It always remains right there. Okay, so that's called an antinode. And similarly, there are places where the superposition of those two waves is always zero, okay, right there. So if you look at that point over there, at, say, this instant of time now, there's a plus and a minus. There's a crest and a trough that add up. Or now, there's a trough and a crest that add up to make that point permanently zero. So So there's zero amplitude of vibration at the nodes, labeled N here. And there's maximum amplitude of vibration at the antinodes, labeled A here. Okay? And the important thing is that individually, there's a right-moving wave, which is red, and a left-moving wave, which is blue. But the sum of the two is not moving, and that's called a standing wave. Okay? So that's the kind of thing that we would expect to be happening inside this box. Okay? It will be a standing wave of wavelength lambda. And the wavelength will be the distance between, say, that node and that node there. That's one full wavelength. You can see there's a sine wave or a negative sine wave. There's a sine wave there. So one complete wavelength is the distance from one node to two nodes over, okay, or the second node over. OK, so excellent. Is that clear? Cool applet, eh? I love that applet. OK. So at the end of the day, what we find is that so we started with a particle with some energy that tells us the momentum is plus or minus blah blah. And associated with that, according to the de Broglie relationship, is some kind of a wave. If we have right moving in a wave, there must be left moving, and so on and so forth. Because the particle is bound, that's very important. Okay, so what we end up with is something like this. Okay, if we had, suppose the particle were not bound, suppose it were just, suppose we had just this situation. Suppose we had a right moving wave that's infinitely long, and a left moving wave that's infinitely long, infinitely long wave trains. And we add those guys together. So it's like this. And we add them together. What we're going to get is a standing wave. We're going to get a, which looks basically like this. And it's infinitely long in both directions. Okay, and there will be places. So the way this standing wave goes, the way it works is, at this end, this is a snapshot at one instant of time. The wave pattern looks like this. As time goes on, this crest here will move down, and this trough here will move up. There will be an instant of time where it's flat, and then this guy will reverse. That crest will be a trough, and that trough will become a crest. Okay? And so this is the kind of picture that you draw for that's what a standing wave looks like. So it oscillates like this, and these points are fixed. Okay? And now there's a very important point here, and that is, when we have a wave confined to a box, the boundaries of the box need to be at these nodes. For example, we could put the boundaries of the box here and here. Mm-hmm. Or we could put the boundaries of the box, say, left boundary here, left right boundary here, or left boundary here, right boundary here. We couldn't, for example, put left boundary here and right boundary here. Okay? Because at the boundary, the waves, the way the waves reflect, they reflect such that their amplitude is zero. If you tried to do this, you would force that wave to zero amplitude, and it couldn't fit. It doesn't fit inside the box. Okay? And so the allowed sizes of box, for a given wavelength, the allowed sizes of box are this big, or this big, or this big, and so on and so forth. Or we'll actually turn that around, and we'll say we have a box of fixed size, and we will look at the allowed standing waves inside that box. Let me actually run another applet here. So Sean, I don't know if we can turn this thing on so quickly again. I can find that other one. Actually, let's just leave that applet. Okay. So let me just say a couple more words, and then we will stop. Okay. So basically, we look at a standing wave pattern like this of a given wavelength, and say the box can be this big, this big, or this big. Or we say we have a thick box of fixed size, and we can put certain standing waves inside that box. So what are the allowed standing waves? Let's draw a picture of those guys. Okay, so between 0 and L, what is the smallest box that we could have? Box goes from here to where? The next one over here. Okay, so what we have is a standing wave like this, which oscillates up and down. Okay, so it would look like this. Okay, so that's what the pattern looks like. And this is, let's just call it psi. It's a function of x, obviously. Okay. We call that psi 0. Okay. And so this is the amplitude of the wave. Okay. And we know that associated with that amplitude of the wave is a particle probability. So suppose that the particle is in some kind of a state where its wavelength is such that, you know, half of a wavelength fits inside the box. Because, of course, this is a full wavelength, it's 2L. So we have a wave such that half of the wavelength fits inside the box. We have this standing wave bouncing back and forth. And what we know is that the probability, the particle probability, is related to the square of, right? So when we're talking about waves coming into this double slit apparatus to get this, this pattern here, is the square of the amplitude. And we identified the square of the amplitude, which is the intensity of the wave, with the particle probability pattern. Okay, so if we square this, we get a curve which looks something like this. Okay? And let's look at another one. Okay, so same size of box between 0 and L. But now we can fit a standing wave in there with more lumps. How many lumps? 2 lumps. Okay, so a standing wave which looks like this. Okay, so it's got a node there and there. Has to have at the ends of the box, but and also a node right in the center. Okay, so the standing wave is doing this sort of thing. If we square that amplitude, what do we get? What does it look like here? 2 positive peaks. Okay, so when I square a positive, I get a positive. When I square a negative, I get also a positive. So I get 2 peaks like that. Okay, and what is this supposed to mean? Well, what this means is if the particle is in this kind of state here, then if we were to look in the box, we would find that maybe the particle is over there. Or if we were to look at a different time, maybe we'd find it over there, and so on. There's a high probability we would find the particle, if we looked inside the box, somewhere in this region, where this pattern, which we'll call P0, is large. And there's low probability that we would find it near the end of the box. Okay. This pattern over here, we'll call this one psi1 here. Okay, so that's the wave amplitude. When we square that amplitude to get the probability, we'll call that probability pattern P1. Okay, so a probability pattern like this means that if we look inside the box, and the particle could be anywhere when we look inside the box, but it's most likely to be found either around here, where the probability pattern is peaked, or around here. It's not likely to be found here or near the ends of the box. Okay, so that's what we've learned so far. And finally, we've also learned about the energy. The energy associated with a particle in this weird state of motion, whatever it is E0 is p squared over 2m. We know that p is h over lambda. So if I plug p equal h over lambda into here, what I get is h squared over 2m lambda squared. What is the wavelength here in terms of L? Right, so the wavelength lambda is 2L here. If I plug for lambda, if I plug in 2L squared, gives me 4L squared times 2 is 8. Okay, so what I get is h squared over 8ml squared. Yeah.
Say you shoot an electron cell?
Yeah.
So the electron goes to one slit, does the wave go to the other slit if the particle which is making the wave has gone to one slit?
Particle is making the wave.
So what we're doing is we're clearly separating between particle and wave here. So what we're imagining is we're saying, okay, here is our double slit apparatus here. We know that it leaves as a particle here because the source is very, very tiny. And definitely it's a localized clump of something coming out. And it hits a detector here. That detector is small in size as well. So what we're detecting is lumps of energy here. Okay, so we know it's a particle here, we just know it's a particle here. What it's doing in between, we don't know. And what we're doing is we're saying we're replacing our knowledge of what it's doing in between with, we're settling for just the ability to calculate the probabilities of it hitting, you know, this way or that way, on, or like this location or that location on the screen. So it's not that the particle is creating the wave or anything like that. The wave, in this interpretation of quantum mechanics, there are different interpretations which we'll talk a little bit about. In this interpretation of quantum mechanics, the wave is just an abstract mathematical device used to calculate the probability of a particle hitting at this location or that location. So we just take this picture, replace it entirely with one where waves go through, look at the intensity pattern of the waves, and that matches the probability pattern of the particles. Okay, but it's particles here and particles there. Waves enter only in trying to understand the probability pattern. Okay, and E1 here, what is the wavelength here in terms of L? So lambda is just L. So we would use this same formula here, and we would get h squared over 2m L squared. How does E1 relate to E0? How big is E1 compared to E0? How much bigger?
Four times.
So E1 is 4 times E0. Okay. So let me just make a note of that here. So if you were to look at various different possible states there, what you will find is the particle that's in that box, it only has certain allowed states. Okay, so that's zero energy. What we found is the first allowed energy, E0, is some non-zero value there. Okay? And the second allowed energy is up here, is 4 times E0. So E1 is 4 times E0. And if you look at the next one, you'll find the next one is at 9 times E0, and so on. Okay, so the point is that that the energy here, you can't, a particle inside a, confined to a box, particle of mass m confined to a box of size L, there's m and L, cannot just have any old energy. Okay, cannot give it like just you know, a small amount of energy and then increase its energy arbitrarily. Okay, it can have only certain discrete allowed values of energy, okay, which depend upon m and L this way. There's Planck's constant involved, h squared over 8m L squared. That's the lowest energy. The next energy is this guy over here. The next energy is this guy over here. The particle cannot have this amount of energy, for example. Okay? So if I want it to go from here to here, I have to give it exactly this amount of energy. If I try to give that particle any energy that's different from this difference here, it just wouldn't accept the energy. If I tried to give the particle this much energy here, it simply wouldn't accept it. It can only accept this amount of energy, and then it will jump to this amount, having this amount of energy. Or it can accept this amount of energy, the difference here, and then it will jump to this. But if I tried to give it this much energy by like flicking it with my finger, it wouldn't accept the energy. Okay? So it has only these discrete allowed values of energy like this. So just to summarize here, so bound, as soon as you have a bound particle, that means bound, say, to a box. Okay, that tells you that according to this de Broglie relationship, a bound particle means a bound wave because lambda is h over p. Particle momentum p, there's an associated wavelength. So now it becomes a bound wave. As soon as you have a wave that's bound to some region, there are reflections back and forth, and there are standing waves. So there are allowed standing waves. So allowed standing waves means waves of only certain wavelengths, which means, using the de Broglie relation again, if you are only allowed certain wavelengths, that means you are only allowed certain
allowed, well, only certain allowed momenta. Which tells us certain allowed energy, because energy is just p squared over 2m. Okay, so the point here is that it's actually superposition. It's this these allowed we only have certain allowed standing waves. It's that superposition thing which is the real mystery, not sort of quantization. Okay, so I guess what I, and the other thing here to say just before we quit here is that this E zero. This is called zero point energy. And that zero-point energy is not zero. Okay, so you might think if I have a particle in a box here, like a bead on a wire here, I can give that bead just zero energy. It can have zero energy. It can just be sitting there. Well, it turns out in the real world, in the quantum world, that's not true. It has always some small amount of energy. There's some minimum energy that's not zero, called the zero-point energy. And that zero-point energy is of huge significance to the nature of our universe. It explains why atoms can exist. It explains why this table exists. And we'll talk about that. Okay, so it's very, very important. And that's it. So why don't we break for lunch? Because we're already a little bit after. Okay.